This is the very first episode of Does Not Compute, and we want to give a huge thank you to Hired for sponsoring that first episode. It's super awesome of them, and we really appreciate it. Now, you've probably heard of Hired, but as a refresher, Hired is a place where engineers and designers can get 5 or more job offers from a bunch of great companies in just a week. They have full-time and contract offers, and there's no drawn-out process to see salary and equity. Those are both upfront. You can view and accept or reject offers before talking to companies. And these are a ton of great pre-screened employers, ranging from startups to large public companies. They're located in 12 great cities, including San Francisco, Seattle, New York City, Boston, Austin, Atlanta, London, and more. It's completely free, and there are no obligations ever. In fact, when you do get a job via Hired, they'll give you $2,000 just to say thanks. Now here's the kicker. If you go to hired.com/doesnotcompute, all one word, sign up and get a job, they will double that bonus. Yeah, seriously, they will give you $4,000 and you get a new job. It's a pretty sweet deal. Again, our thanks to Hired, and make sure to check out hired.com/doesnotcompute. It's totally free and totally awesome. Let me grab another LaCroix real quick. I'll be back in just like 30 seconds.
Oh, man.
And then I'll be good to go.
I want one.
So I saw this article not too long ago about magic numbers. It's by Elliot Sykes. And he kind of talks about how to eliminate magic numbers in your code. And this is something to me that I think about this a lot. Like, what are little improvements that I can make that seem small but are actually going to make a big difference in long-term readability and maintainability? And so this is a pretty simple article. It's just talking about, you know, constants. So instead of just having age in years greater than 13, have like minimum age in years equals 13 as a constant, and then compare against that constant, which I think makes a lot of sense. And it's definitely something that makes code more readable.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That's something that I learned from you when I was working on Spare Chair. And I believe we were having to set rates, basically what Spare Chair would get from each charge. And you put it in initializer, and I was trying to figure out why you were doing that. It seemed like a lot of work just kind of to put this number here. And the more I thought about it, the more it made sense to remove it and have it out of the way. And obviously, you can access it via the name. I think it's a lot cleaner. And when you're looking at the actual code on the other side, you see basically a name that explains what this number is and not just a random number.
Yeah, totally. Instead of saying age in years greater than 13, like, why is it 13? As opposed to something that says right. Minimum age in years, it's like, oh, at least you understand that that's like, there's some restriction on age there. Instead of just checking like randomly, why are you looking at this person's age? Why does that matter?
Yeah, totally. I think my favorite part about this article actually is the last kind of code block. He actually gives out a list of real world applications. And that's something that I feel that is missing a lot from a lot of articles or educational resources. They might outline a technique, and that's that. But he actually provides a pretty good list of how you would actually use this. I mean, there's one called prompt text. There's one called API base. I mean, API base being pretty self-explanatory, you know. So if you're reading that in the code, you're seeing API base. You're like, oh, that's the base URL for this API.
There was actually one of his examples is minutes per day, 60 times 24. Okay, fair enough. I actually saw this really interesting thing. It was a Microsoft open source project, and I'll try to find this and put it in the show notes. It was just released a week or two ago, I think, and they had days or hours per year, I think it was, defined as 365 times 24, mm-hmm. which is not correct because that's not how many hours there are in a year.
Sure.
And it's just date math is so, so complex. So anytime you cannot repeat that kind of thing, it makes so much sense.
Yeah, you put it somewhere else where it's kind of set and it's known to be correct, so you don't have to worry about it or mess with it or screw it up.
Right. 365 times 24 does not account for, you know, any sort of leap, anything. It's just like such a naive calculation.
Yeah, it really is. I also like how he stored the car types. So basically, he's got a car types hash, and each one is the different regex to validate if it's a Visa, MasterCard, Diners Club, whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's actually pretty useful, and I might actually use that in my next project coming up.
You're not using Stripe?
So I talked to them about Stripe, and I think I might have talked them into it, but you never know.
Well, what were they wanting to go with?
They didn't have any ideas.
Okay.
Basically, yeah, so for anyone that doesn't have any context, I'll be building an app that will deal with shipping products, so you'd be able to buy products, basically an e-commerce setup, right? So these people didn't have any idea in terms of how to actually accept payments. I think our go-to default octopus is Stripe, just because the documentation is so great and the actual product is so great. So I basically gave him the spiel. I was like, yeah, Stripe's awesome. We've used it a bunch. We've never had any issues. It's great. And they responded with, okay, let's Google a little bit.
So, oh, no. And there's always PayPal. Should we go with PayPal? It's been around for a very long time.
I would beg them. I would crawl on the floor and grab their shoes at that point. Because I've only ever, well, actually, take that back. So I worked with Stripe, and I also worked with Balanced before they closed down. And Balanced was okay.
They got purchased by Stripe, right? Or something? Or they're migrating their users over to Stripe?
So what they did was they set up a bunch of migration guides for people to go to Stripe. So if you're using this feature, this is how you could implement that in Stripe. And a big thing for the project that I had worked on was that they were using the
escrow stuff?
The escrow feature, yeah, the escrow feature. So the charges would all dump into a big account, and then they would get paid out at a later time.
Some users of the site were selling a product, and some users of the site were buying a product from those sellers?
Yes, yeah.
Anytime someone bought a product from the site, all of the money went to the site, and then part of it was distributed later on to the sellers.
Right, yeah. So people could buy products Monday through Thursday, and then on Friday would actually get paid for the previous pay period.
So we were talking about code quality, and really all of that kind of comes back to you actually just wrote a fantastic blog post about this.
Yeah, earlier this morning, actually. So I was watching this TV show with my roommate Chris, and I believe it's called Mike Holmes, Home Inspector. And the premise of the show is this guy, Mike Holmes, he gets phone calls from new homeowners that have some concerns. And he goes to their house, and they kind of tell him what they're worried about. Oh, this, you know, this, the floor is dipping here, or, you know, it's always cold in here, no matter how hot we turn the, or how high we turn the heater. So he actually kind of does another inspection, and he normally finds a lot of things that the previous home inspector missed or just didn't report, period. And the whole time I was watching the show, I just was thinking about how that is actually really similar to writing code, and how I feel like a lot of applications, or maybe, you know, it's, I think maybe hopefully it's getting better, but maybe in the past, applications just aren't built very well, and that could be just because the people working on the app didn't know any better, or it's because the budget was, you know, the time frame was too short or whatever, and that resulted in a pretty broken application that either, you know, ruins data or loses data or makes it, you know, difficult for people to use. But the whole time I was watching the show, I was just thinking about, man, you know, a lot of these problems that these homeowners are having could have been avoided if the contractors up front would have just, you know, asked for a little more time to do something correctly, or maybe were more, a little bit more educated on how to do things the right way, or maybe they didn't know about a certain piece of the code, because I know it gets really complicated.
Totally. It, for me, it comes back to the magic numbers thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's a little bit more work to go and define all these things as constants and figure out the proper name for them, but really, in the end, it's going to save you so much time and headache. And it's just a tiny bit more effort up front, but in the long term, it's just way, way better. It totally changes the maintainability and the reliability of the product.
Yeah, definitely.
If you need to make changes, or let's say you stop working on it and somebody else works on it, they don't have to go in and spend a month figuring out what all these numbers mean. They can just read the names, if things are named properly.
Sure.
And say, oh, yeah, of course, that makes a lot of sense. We need to make sure that we're calculating. We don't want to type 24 times 60 all over, because you might accidentally type 24 times 70 or 23 times 60 or whatever.
Right, yeah.
It's so easy to make those mistakes, whereas if things are defined in one place, any of these best practice, you know, don't repeat yourself, all that stuff, it just makes such a huge difference in the long term.
In the long term, yeah. I mean, a lot of people up front would say something like, well, why put in the extra effort, or why waste the extra time to do this when deadlines are coming up, etc. And your point is exactly correct, is because it leads to a better product if you ever have to work on it again, or if you're sending code to somebody else that might have to work on it. Say you're building an MVP and the founder eventually will hire a team to work on this thing. You don't want to screw them over just because you need to get something done quickly, right? It's part of being good at what you do, I think. In the post that I wrote, I asked a question to myself, basically, you know, how do I stay on top of this stuff? How do I make sure that I'm writing code that is clean, that is readable? And I gave out a few answers. And like, for example, one of them would be using linters. You know, I don't think there's any reason to not lint all of your code.
No. I mean, linters are essentially free in terms of like mental burden. Once it's set up, it's set up, it runs, and it tells you about things that you can improve. And that's such a handy thing to have, is like just something sanity checking you all the time, being like, hey, this method, I'm thinking specifically of RuboCop here right now.
Yep.
Hey, this method maybe is a little bit too complex.
Yeah, totally.
And it's like, oh yeah, okay, I know that, but having someone remind me, or something remind me, it just really solidifies that and makes me way more likely to go and fix the problem.
Well, the linters are kind of twofold, because number one, they check your code for syntactical errors. Hey, you're missing a semicolon, or your indentation is incorrect here. You know, and the second half of that is that they also check your code for best practices that are kind of community accepted practices, right? So an example of that would be the method being too complicated, or RuboCop saying, hey, this method is too long, why not split it up? Or, hey, you have too many conditions happening in this method, it might be confusing to follow along with, so you might need to split that up as well.
Right, and I think a common argument against linters is that, oh, but I don't like all those practices. Well, any good linter, the vast majority of them will let you specify very explicitly what you care about and what you don't care about and how you care about things. So if you like tabs versus spaces in a given language, you can set that up. If you want your methods to be a little bit longer, maybe if you want to allow that, that's totally fine. But letting you set those standards within, whether it's yourself or an organization, I think a lot of the benefits from this come from the organizational side. Because yeah, if you have, you know, 5 programmers or 10 programmers working on something, then code standards, you know, tabs versus spaces, you don't want that to be a debate. That just needs to be a thing that everybody agrees on, and you have something enforcing that going forward.
Yeah, and it's really easy to set that up. For example, at Octopus, you know, there's me and you, and there's Chris, and there's Nick, and we all program for Octopus. And I just set up a continuous integration server that runs these tests for us, and we sat down together, and it didn't take more than a half an hour, and we just nailed down how we like to write code, basically our style guide. I tossed it in the config files, put it on the server, and that's that. So anytime you run a test on that server, it's going to check it against the rules that we set up, and it was that easy.
Totally. And now every project going forward, we know that things are going to be consistent. We know that they're going to match these set of rules. So if I have to hop in a project that I haven't worked on before, or if you do, or if anybody does, we already have sort of a sense in our mind of what to expect there, and there's no ambiguity. There's nothing confusing about it. All the conventions that we've agreed upon will already be in place.
Yeah. There's no surprises. You can just start jumping and start working like you had actually written this from scratch yourself, which I think is awesome. And I think that overall quality, I think, for our software is just increased because of that. Linters are huge. I think it's something that I end up telling a lot of people about. People ask questions, and I'll just say, hey, use a linter if you're not sure. Another really good resource, I think, would be to tap into all these communities that are popping up. I personally always found IRC kind of off-putting. I would ask questions and people would be like, you're an idiot. You don't know this. You're an idiot, basically. And so I guess with Slack coming about, there's a lot of new kind of communities popping up, like Slash Rocket that we're both in, and also the Spec Slack channels that we're both in. It's just a collection of people that are wanting to learn how to program or get better at programming or just enjoy talking about it. And I've actually learned a ton by throwing the code that I'm working on in a gist, posting it in one of those channels and saying, hey, what do you guys think about this? Is there anything that I can or should fix or refactor? You know, what are you guys' thoughts? In general, I find that it sparks a good discussion and people really enjoy kind of digging into this sort of thing. But I've learned a lot, I guess, learning from other people's experiences.
Totally. And for me, those are useful not just because of the direct, hey, can you help me with this specific piece of code? But it's also super cool to just throughout the day see what people are talking about. And like, it introduces you to this community of people who are very focused on one thing. They're like, I'm really into development, or I'm really into design, or I'm really into this specific programming language even. I mean, Slash Rocket is general dev now, but it started out as Ruby and Rails specific. It's super cool that there are these communities out there where you can see, like, you can just be exposed to this whole world of interesting writing and talking about all these topics.
Yeah, and I actually think it's very helpful for me in the sense that I actually work, you know, I guess we both do. We work on front-end projects. We also do back-end development and also DevOps stuff, too. And so I can go into Slash Rocket and I can jump in the DevOps channel and be like, hey, you know, what's a good baseline for security? That's something that, you know, I'm spread pretty thin, I guess. And so I'm not a huge DevOps buff. But if I have specific questions, I can go there and ask people that are, you know, really, really secure in their DevOps chops. And it's been a huge resource for me to be able to go do that.
They're secure in their knowledge, and they're explicitly there to help people, which is awesome.
Yeah, it's a great resource.
That's so cool. And I don't know what exactly the difference is between Slack and IRC, but there's something about the communities that I've seen on Slack that are just very, way more accepting and open of newcomers and people who are there to learn.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess maybe I wasn't in the right IRC channels. I don't know. But for the most part, my experience with IRC wasn't great, with the exception of the Mapbox people. I remember Tom Macrat, I think his name is, has been very helpful to me in IRC. But I think he might have been the only one in all of my years of asking questions. You know, I felt like I would log on to the server and I'd be like that little kid, hey guys, what about this? And they're basically just, get out of here. Like, you know, the little brother popping into the chat room. The Slack communities are invaluable. Even for people like my brother and, you know, my mom, they've been kind of dabbling into programming. First thing I do is say, hey, download Slack, jump in Slash Rocket, ask questions, just observe. Because that's how I learned, was asking you questions incessantly over Slack or over Skype. And, you know, I had questions, I asked you and you answered them, and that's how I learned. And I think that if you have people to ask questions of, it makes things a lot less daunting than trying to Google and read more technical documents or read the documentation, which I think is important. But when you're first starting out, I think it's a lot more daunting. So having something that's more personable, a place where you can go to actually talk to people and ask them questions, I think it's huge.
The other thing about just Googling on your own is that you actually linked me an article, I think this morning, about how, oh, it's written in a book, it must be true.
Yeah.
And then this was specifically about a programming book where there were like 5 errors in 50 lines of code written in a published book. And so if you're new to programming and you don't know how to tell what is valid or not, then going on the internet and looking stuff up can be really scary because, first of all, you're not really sure what to look up. And when you find something, you don't know how valid it is or not. And having a community of people instead of just individual resources, I think, makes it so much easier to say, to like find ideas that are validated by a group of people, which obviously doesn't mean they're infallible, but it definitely means that they are more likely to be at least somewhat correct.
Exactly. And so when I was learning how to program, I did a whole lot of copying and pasting. Stack Overflow problem, copy and paste it. You know, copy and paste the accepted answer, basically.
Oh, yeah.
And I was listening to Developer T the other day, and he challenged the listeners. He said, when you run into, say, like, you hit a stack trace, and instead of just copy, because this is exactly what I always do, I copy and paste the error line, paste it into Chrome, hit enter, read the first accepted message, and then generally don't actually try to figure out what was happening, I guess. So he challenged everyone. He said, instead of copying and pasting it right away, actually read the error message and don't try to Google it for, give it at least 5 or 10 minutes. He said, think about the problem for 5 to 10 minutes before you try to Google it. And he said, a lot of the times you'll be able to figure out the issue just because of the message of the error message or something like that, you know?
Totally.
Basically clues that the program is giving you saying, hey, this is broken, you know?
Totally. That is absolutely in line. One thing that I've learned a ton from is I'll still Google it and I'll look at the accepted answer. But instead of just copy-pasting that into my app, I will actually have that open in my browser and then have my editor open and then manually retype it while reading through each thing. It's just because that really forces you to think about what that code is doing and like why it's solving this problem.
That's really good.
So don't copy-paste it. Just retype it while even you can read it and retype it, and maybe you'll notice a syntax error, or maybe you'll notice a something that could just be improved in some small way. No matter what happens, you're still going to get a little bit better because, first of all, you're typing more code, and anytime you're writing code, you're getting better just because it's more practice.
It's something that I actually had to step back and learn. The hard way was to actually try to understand everything that was happening. So when I first started to learn Rails, you know, Rails kind of does a lot of magical things in the background, and I was pretty new to Ruby at that point too. So I was having trouble distinguishing the difference between what is Ruby syntax and what Rails is kind of doing in the background. And I was kind of doing that same thing. I have to make this feature. Let me Google how to do that. Okay, let me set it up. Oh, it doesn't quite work right. And then I would ask you, hey, Paul, why isn't this working right? And then you'll ask me, well, what were the steps to get you to this point? And I would respond with, I'm not totally sure. And you're basically like, well, no wonder you don't know how to fix this because you don't know how you set it up. You don't know this. You don't know what's going into this in the first place.
Yeah, you need to understand the input before you can understand the output.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, it's such a funny thing to think about because if, you know, I'm a programmer, of course I'm writing this stuff, but it doesn't mean that I actually understand what I'm typing or what I'm pasting. And so that took a long time for me to pick up on was, oh, I should actually be able to describe to somebody every method in this application because I'm building this thing, so I should know how it functions from the inside out.
And that's not just for your own being able to say like, oh, I understand every method in this application, look at me. No, it's so that it makes your life easier because if there's a bug and you know exactly why things happen in an application, it's so much easier for you to go in and say, oh yeah, there's this problem that'll take me 5 seconds to fix instead of 20 minutes because I understand the flow of this application. And obviously as things get more complex, you know, if you're writing an operating system, engineers at Apple, they obviously, there's no way they can fully keep the entire OS in their mind at all times. That's unrealistic. But for a lot of stuff like web-sized applications, it's not crazy to have the majority of an application stored inside your head at any given time and understand how and why things work.
Right. Well, even if you can't pull it off directly or pull it directly out of your mind, you should be able to look at the code around it or follow the chain and then be able to explain how it works and how the program flow is working. And that's something that I started to do with myself. For example, if I'm running into a CSS problem, I will look at what I want to happen, and then I'll look at what's happening, and I'll look at the properties that I'm giving it, and I'll think, okay, what does inline block actually do? What does this actually do? And I found that to be very useful because then you stop having repeat problems. So for example, when I was working with my mom a little bit, she would ask me questions about CSS and I would say, well, how are you going to fix that? And she would just start rattling off, display inline block, float left. And then I would stop her and say, well, what does display inline block actually do? What does float left actually do? And make her actually describe to me what those things are doing. And that helped her grow and learn much quicker than just, you know, typing random stuff or typing the first thing that comes to mind and seeing if it works.
If you don't know what a hammer does, then it's going to be really hard for you to use a hammer right. So we found a couple things on the internet this week that we thought were super awesome, and we just wanted to share them with everybody. The first one of those was certificatechain.io. Sean, do you want to tell me a little bit about what that does?
Yeah, so for anyone that's never had to install an SSL certificate on for their site, it is the worst. So you would buy you essentially would go to an SSL provider and you would buy a certificate, and they'll give you maybe four or five different files, and they'll tell you that those four or five different files need to be concatenated into one file in a certain order, but they don't explicitly tell you that order. And I've done it a few times, and I've had to Google a bunch, and it's led to lots of frustration. But for certificate chain, what it does is you actually paste your certificates in a text box in their site, and then you click a button and it orders them for you.
So in the past, this was a combination of having to like either copy paste or, you know, cat the files together in some order that generally is not specified by the person or the company that issues the certificate. So they just give you four certificates and they're like, these need to go in the same thing. Best of luck. And then you just do that for a while and try and upload them and see if it works. And it's just the worst. It's so difficult to figure out what the valid order is. But this site, like Sean said, you just paste it in and it returns you the valid order of everything, all set and good to go, all in a single file. And then you can just upload that to your server and your SSL is good to go. It's such a huge time saver and it just removes a giant headache. A lot of times when you're deploying, things are, you know, on a tight time crunch and you just have to get it out now. And so that's just one less thing that you have to think about during that time, which is very, very cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's pretty awesome.
And then the second thing, Sean, you linked me this the other day, the Great Suspender. This is a Chrome plugin, and it has a bunch of options, but by default, what it does is basically removes all the HTML from your tabs and stops them from executing after a certain amount of time idle. So, for example, if you open the Rails documentation or something, and then you have 50 tabs open, over time, the old ones will automatically shut themselves down in a way without closing. They're still there in your browser. But if you go back to them, it'll say, you know, click to reload. And what this does is it obviously helps with processing power and memory consumption. So this can be huge for a bunch of people, laptop users. I think especially if you want to save battery life. That's a nice automated way to do it. And then you were saying something about at work, right? Your iMac?
Yeah. So at work, I work on an iMac, but it's an older iMac. And so if I'm running Photoshop and Illustrator and Chrome all at the same time, you know, I'm not even working and I have 18 tabs open right now. So if I'm running all that stuff at the same time, you know, the RAM gets used up pretty quickly. And I've found that actually it does make a difference for me.
That's super cool. It's just one of those kind of nice quality of life things where it helps you out a little bit without you really having to think about it ever. And you don't lose any of your tabs. They're all still there in your browser. They just unload from memory. So you just click and it'll refresh.
And you can whitelist tabs as well, or you can whitelist certain URLs. If you want, say, for example, localhost 3000 to not turn off, then it won't. And it's pretty simple to update those settings. So there's really no reason not to be using this.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, you can also tell it to not suspend when there's filled form inputs. So if you're worried about losing an order or something on a website or some kind of progress on a form or a survey, then it'll handle that as well. It's super flexible. Highly recommend that you check that out. All right. I think the last thing that we wanted to talk about today, you mentioned time boxing to me. You said, I'm trying time boxing. I don't know what that is.
It's this new fad called time boxing, Paul.
Time boxing.
Time boxing. No, I was listening to the Design Details podcast with Adam Morris, also known as Murmurs, and he mentioned time boxing, and he mentioned that for certain activities, he will basically set a timer and say, I'm doing this for this amount of time, and then he will do that activity. And I thought to myself, that seems like it could make me productive. I'm going to try it. So essentially what I'm doing is I have a few different priorities, or I have a few different things that I want to make priorities in my life. For example, you know, obviously programming is one of them because that's what I do for a living. I have been playing guitar for like almost 13 years now, you know, so that's obviously a priority. I don't want to slide backwards on any of that progress. And so there's just a number of things that I want to make sure that I'm keeping up with. And I find that it's easy to get sucked into other things and waste a lot of time into things like Netflix, for example. And so what I'm doing is I have a number of priorities and I say, I want to do this for X amount of minutes per day. So then what I'll do is when I get home from work, I will set a timer for an hour and I will only play guitar for that hour. So I'll turn all my other notifications off. I won't have Netflix running. You know, I'll go somewhere quiet. I'll set the timer and I'll do only that activity for that period of time. And I find that while the timer is running, since I'm not being distracted, I'm actually getting a better practice in for guitar. Because for things like guitar, you can actually play guitar, but not actually get any better, if that makes sense.
Right, you can just noodle. It doesn't help you at all. It's just doing the thing. This kind of sounds similar to the Pomodoro thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really big a while back, the tomato one.
Yep.
Where you set a timer for 25 minutes, you do a thing for 25 minutes, and then you take a 5-minute break or whatever, and then you set another 25-minute timer and do another thing.
Yeah, exactly. Except for with this idea, I just set the timer for whatever I want it to be.
Right, it's not the specific 25-minute.
Yeah, and I find with Pomodoro, I can do a few Pomodoros in a row, and then I kind of trail off or forget to start a timer or something. And I think for things like working, you know, I can focus enough at work to actually get work done. But just for me, I guess when I'm not at work, it's a way to introduce some structure into things that I want to do without feel like it's taking up so much of my time.
I think that makes a ton of sense because especially with programming, at least for me, I can't really get any programming done unless I have a nice block where I know that's the only thing in my life.
Yeah.
I don't want to think about anything else. I don't want to think about emails. I don't want to think about chat. I don't want to think about anything. I don't want to think about sleep or food or breathing. It needs to be the thing I'm doing right now for the next 4 hours is I'm writing some code.
Well, I often think about LaCroix and food while I'm coding.
That to me is just when I'm most productive and not like, oh, I'm 5% more productive. I'm many times more productive when I just have that solid block where I know that's what I'm doing.
But are you 10x, Paul, when you're doing that?
This has been Does Not Compute, hosted by Sean Washington and Paul Straw. That's me. Thanks so much for listening, and another huge thank you to Hired. If you're looking for a new development or design job, be sure to check out hired.com/doesnotcompute, and you'll get $4,000 when you accept a new job through them. If you've enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe in iTunes. You can also find us at twitter.com/dncast and facebook.com/dncast.